even when those frames have come to be accepted as everyday and commonplace. Chapter 11. Metaphors of Terror. September 16, 2001. Edited July 2014. Our brains had to change. Everything we know is physically instantiated in the neural systems of our brains. What we knew before September 11th about America, Manhattan, the World Trade Center, air travel, and the Pentagon were intimately tied up with our identities and with a vast amount of what we took for granted about everyday life. It was all there physically in our neural synapses. Manhattan, the gateway to America for generations of immigrants, the chance to live free of war, pogroms, religious and political oppression. The Manhattan skyline had meaning in my life even more than I knew. When I thought of it, I thought of my mother. Born in Poland, she arrived as an infant. Grew up in Manhattan, worked in factories for 25 years, and had family, friends, a life, a child. She didn't die in concentration camps. She didn't fear for her life. For her, America was not all that she might have wanted it to be, but it was plenty. I grew up in Bayonne, New Jersey, across the bay from that skyline. The World Trade Center wasn't there then, but over the years, as the major feature of the skyline, it became for me, as for others, the symbol of New York. Not only the business center of America, but also the cultural center and the communications center. As such, it became a symbol for America itself. A symbol for what it meant to be able to go about your everyday life free of oppression, and just able to live and do your job, whether as a secretary or an artist, a manager or a fireman, a salesman or a teacher or a TV star. I wasn't consciously aware of it, but those images were intimately tied to my identity, both as an individual and as an American. And all that and so much more were there physically as part of my brain on the morning of September 11th, 2001. The devastation that hit those towers that morning hit me. Buildings are metaphorically people. We see features, eyes, nose, and mouth in their windows. I now realize that the image of the plane going into South Tower was for me an image of a bullet going through someone's head, the flames spouting from the other side like blood spurting out. It was an assassination. The tower's falling was a body falling. The bodies falling were me, relatives, friends. Strangers who had smiled as they had passed me on the street screamed as they fell past me. The image afterward was hell. Ashes, smoke, and steam rising, the building skeleton, darkness, suffering, death. The people who attacked the towers got into my brain even 3,000 miles away. All those symbols were connected to more of my identity than I could have realized. To make sense of this, my very brain had to change. And change it did, painfully, day and night. By day, the consequences flooded my mind. By night, the images had me breathing heavily, nightmares keeping me awake. Those symbols lived in the emotional centers of my brain. As their meanings changed, I felt emotional pain. It was not just me. It was everyone in this country and many in other countries. The assassins managed not only to kill thousands of people, but also to reach in and change the brains of people all over America. It is remarkable to know that 200 million of my countrymen feel as wrenched as I do. The power of the images. As a metaphor analyst, I want to begin with the power of the images and where that power comes from. There are a number of metaphors for buildings. A common visual metaphor is that buildings are heads with windows as eyes. The metaphor is dormant, there in our brains waiting to be awakened. The image of the plane going into South Tower of the World Trade Center activated it. The tower became a head with windows as eyes, the edge of the tower the temple. The plane going through it became a bullet going through someone's head, the flames pouring from the other side, the blood spurting out. Metaphorically, tall buildings are people standing erect. As each tower fell, it became a body falling. We are not consciously aware of the metaphorical images, but they are part of the power and the horror we experience when we see them. Each of us, in the premotor cortex of our brains, has what are called mirror neurons connected to visual areas. Such neurons fire either when we perform an action or when we see the same action performed by someone else. There are connections from that part of the brain to the emotional centers. Such neural circuits are believed to be the basis of empathy. This works literally. When we see a plane coming toward the building and imagine people in the building, we feel the plane coming toward us. When we see the building topple toward others, we feel the building toppling toward us. It also works metaphorically. If we see the plane going through the building and unconsciously we evoke the metaphor of the building as a head with the plane going through its temple, then we sense, unconsciously but powerfully, being shot through the temple. If we evoke the metaphor of the building as a person and see the building fall to the ground in pieces, then we sense, again unconsciously but powerfully, that we are falling to the ground in pieces. Our systems of metaphorical thought, interacting with our mirror neurons, turn external literal horrors into felt metaphorical horrors. Here are some other metaphorical and symbolic effects. Control is up. You have control over the situation. You're on top of things. This has always been an important basis of towers as symbols of power. In this case, the toppling of the towers meant loss of control, loss of power. Phallic imagery. Towers are symbols of phallic power, and their collapse reinforces the idea of loss of power. Another kind of phallic imagery was more central here. The planes penetrating the towers with a plume of heat, and the Pentagon, a vaginal image from the air penetrated by the plane as missile. These phallic interpretations came from women who felt violated both by the attack and the images on TV. A society is a building. A society can have a foundation which may or may not be solid. It can crumble and fall. The World Trade Center was symbolic of American society. When it crumbled and fell, the threat was to more than a building. Standing. We think metaphorically of things that perpetuate over time as standing. During the Gulf War, George H.W. Bush kept saying, "This will not stand," meaning that the situation would not be perpetuated over time. The World Trade Center was built to last 10,000 years. When it crumbled, it metaphorically raised the question of whether American power and American society would last. And that was why it was attacked. Building as temple. Here we had the destruction of the temple of capitalist commerce, which lies at the heart of our society. Our minds play tricks on us. The image of the Manhattan skyline became unbalanced. We were used to seeing it with the towers there. Our minds imposed our old image of the towers, and the sight of them gone gave one the illusion of imbalance, as if Manhattan were sinking. Given the symbolism of Manhattan as the promise of America, it appeared metaphorically as if that promise were sinking. The Freedom Tower now stands at One World Trade Center. It's not as distinctive, and its meaning is not the same. It does not represent the stability of normal life in America. Hell. We had the persistent image day after day of the charred and smoking remains. Hell. The World Trade Center was a potent symbol tied into our understanding of our country and ourselves in myriad ways. all of what we know is physically embodied in our brains. To incorporate the new knowledge requires a physical change in the synapses of our brains, a physical reshaping of our neural system. The physical violence was not only in New York and Washington. Physical changes, violent ones, have been made to the brains of all Americans. How the administration framed the event. The Bush administration's framings and reframings and its search for metaphors should be noted. The initial framing was as a crime with victims and perpetrators to be brought to justice and punished. The crime frame entails law, courts, lawyers, trials, sentencings, appeals, and so on. It was hours before crime changed to war, with casualties, enemies, military action, war powers, and so on. Donald Rumsfeld and other Bush administration officials pointed out that this situation did not fit our understanding of war. There were enemies and casualties, all right, but no enemy army, no regiments, no tanks, no ships, no air force, no battlefields, no strategic targets, and no clear victory. The war frame just didn't fit. Colin Powell had always argued that no troops should ever be committed without specific objectives, a clear and achievable definition of victory, and a clear exit strategy, and that open-ended commitments should not be used. But he also pointed out that none of these was present in this war. Because the concept of war didn't fit, there was a frantic search for metaphors. First, Bush called the terrorists cowards. But this didn't seem to work too well for martyrs who willingly sacrificed their lives for their moral and religious ideals. Then he spoke of smoking them out of their holes as if they were rodents, and Rumsfeld spoke of drying up the swamp they live in as if they were snakes or lowly swamp creatures. The conceptual metaphors here were moral is up, immoral is down. They are lowly. And immoral people are animals that live close to or in the ground. Bush speechwriter David Frum created the phrase Axis of Evil, which was used in Bush's 2002 State of the Union address, to refer to Iran, Iraq, and North Korea, and was used over and over by the Bush administration in justifying the war in Iraq. Axis was a reference to the enemy Axis powers of World War II. Germany, Italy, and Japan, which spanned the Western and Eastern hemispheres and represented the global distribution of America's deadly enemies. Lumping Iraq with Iran and North Korea suggested that Iraq was developing nuclear weapons, the non-existent weapons of mass destruction, and gave a pretext for invading Iraq. Axis, because it included Japan, evoked the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, and symbolically equated the September 11th attack with Pearl Harbor, again as a justification for going to war. On the assumption that America contains the essence of morality and democracy, the shining city on the hill, anyone attacking America was evil. And what happened on September 11th certainly felt evil. The use of the word evil in the Bush administration's discourse worked in the following way. In conservative, strict father morality, see Moral Politics, Chapter 5, evil is a palpable thing, a force in the world. To stand up to evil, you have to be morally strong. If you're weak, you let evil triumph, so that weakness in itself is a form of evil, as is promoting weakness. Evil is inherent, an essential trait that determines how you will act in the world. Evil people do evil things. No further explanation is necessary. There can be no social causes of evil, no religious rationale for evil, no reasons or arguments for evil. The enemy of evil is good. If our enemy is evil, we are inherently good. Good is our essential nature, and what we do in the battle against evil is good. Good and evil are locked in a battle which is conceptualized metaphorically as a physical fight in which the stronger wins. Only superior strength can defeat evil, and only a show of strength can keep evil at bay. Not to show overwhelming strength is immoral, since it will induce evildoers to perform more evil deeds because they'll think they can get away with it. To oppose a show of superior strength is therefore immoral. Nothing is more important in the battle of good against evil, and if some innocent non-combatants get in the way and get hurt, it is a shame, but it is to be expected, and nothing can be done about it. Indeed, performing lesser evils in the name of good is justified. Lesser evils, like curtailing individual liberties, sanctioning political assassinations, overthrowing governments, torturing, hiring criminals, and creating collateral damage. Then there is the basic security metaphor, security as containment, keeping the evildoers out. Secure our borders, keep them and their weapons out of our airports, have marshals on the planes. Most security experts say that there is no sure way to keep terrorists out or to deny them the use of some weapon or other. A determined, well-financed terrorist organization can penetrate any security system, or they can choose other targets, say oil tankers. Yet the security as containment metaphor is powerful. It is what lies behind the missile shield proposal. Rationality might say that the September 11th attack showed the missile shield is pointless, but it strengthened the use of the security as containment metaphor. As soon as you say national security, the security as containment metaphor will be activated, and with it, a missile shield. The conservative advantage. The reaction of the Bush administration was just what you would expect a conservative reaction would be. Pure, strict father morality. There is evil loose in the world. We must show our strength and wipe it out. Retribution and vengeance are called for. If there are casualties or collateral damage, so be it. The reaction from liberals and progressives was far different. Justice is called for, not vengeance. Understanding and restraint are what is needed. The model for our action should be the rescue workers and doctors, the healers, not the bombers. We should not be like them. We should not take innocent lives in bringing the perpetrators to justice. Massive bombing of Afghanistan and Iraq with the killing of innocents will show that we are no better. But the Bush administration's conservative message dominated the media. The event was framed in their terms. As Newt Gingrich put it on the Fox network, retribution is justice. It is vital to understand the history of this framing now because it is coming up again, with the conservative attack on Obama's call for the use of soft power, diplomacy, and economic leverage, and the conservatives' call for a military buildup and intervention in the world's trouble spots. I have been reminded over and over of Gandhi's words, "Be the change you wish to see in the world." The words apply to governments as well as to individuals. Causes. There are at least three kinds of causes of radical Islamic terrorism. Worldview, the religious rationale. Social and political conditions. Cultures of despair. Means, the enabling conditions. The Bush administration discussed only the third, the means that enable attacks to be carried out. These include leadership, for example, bin Laden, host countries, training facilities and bases, financial backing, cell organization, information networks, and so on. These do not include the first and second on the list. Worldview, the religious rationale. After the bombing occurred, the question that kept being asked in the media was, "Why do they hate us so much?" It is important at the outset to separate moderate to liberal Islam from radical Islamic fundamentalists who do not represent most Muslims. Radical Islamic fundamentalists hate our culture. They have a worldview that is incompatible with the way that Americans and other Westerners live their lives. One part of this worldview concerns women, who are to hide their bodies, should have no right to property, and so on. Western sexuality, mores, music, and women's equality all violate their values. And the ubiquity of American cultural products like movies and music throughout the world offends them. A second part concerns theocracy. They believe that governments should be run by clerics according to strict Islamic law. A third concerns holy sites like those in Jerusalem, which they believe should be under Islamic political and military control. A fourth concerns the commercial and military incursions by Westerners on Islamic soil, which they liken to the invasion of the hated Crusaders. The way they see it, our culture spits in the face of theirs. A fifth concerns jihad, a holy war to protect and defend the faith. A sixth is the idea of a martyr, a man willing to sacrifice himself for the cause. His reward is eternal glory, an eternity in heaven surrounding by willing young virgins. In some cases, there is a promise that his family will be taken care of by the community. Social and political conditions. Cultures of despair. Most Islamic would-be martyrs not only share these beliefs, but also have grown up in a culture of despair. They have nothing to lose. Eliminate such poverty and you eliminate the breeding ground for most terrorists. Though the September 11th terrorists were relatively well-to-do. When the Bush administration spoke of eliminating terror, it did not appear to be talking about eliminating cultures of despair and the social conditions that lead one to want to give up life to martyrdom. Princeton Lyman of the Aspen Institute made an important proposal that the worldwide anti-terrorist coalition being formed should address the causal real-world conditions. Country by country, the conditions, both material and political, leading to despair need to be addressed, with a worldwide commitment to ending them. It should be done because it is a necessary part of addressing the causes of terrorism, and because it is right. It never happened. What about the first cause, the radical Islamic worldview itself? Military action won't change it. Social action won't change it. Worldviews live in the minds of people. How can one change those minds? And if not present minds, then future minds. The West cannot. Those minds can only be changed by moderate and liberal Muslims. Clerics, teachers, elders, respected community members. There is no shortage of them. I doubt that they are well organized, but the world needs them to be well organized and effective. It is vital that moderate and liberal Muslims form a unified voice against hate, and with it, terror. Remember that Taliban means student. Those who teach hate in Islamic schools must be replaced. And we in the West cannot replace them. This can only be done by an organized, moderate, nonviolent Islam. The West can make the suggestion and offer extensive resources, but we alone are powerless to carry it out. We depend on the goodwill and courage of moderate Islamic leaders. To gain it, we must show our goodwill by beginning in a serious way to address the social and political conditions that lead to despair. Thinking of the enemy as evil means not taking the primary causes seriously. Public discourse. The Honorable Barbara Lee, Democrat, California, who I am proud to acknowledge as my representative in Congress, in casting the lone vote against giving President Bush full congressional approval for carrying out his war on terrorism as he saw fit, said the following. I am convinced that military action will not prevent further acts of international terrorism against the United States. This is a very complex and complicated matter. However difficult this vote may be, some of us must urge the use of restraint. Our country is in a state of mourning. Some of us must say, let us step back for a moment. Let us just pause for a minute and think through the implications of our actions today so that this does not spiral out of control. I have agonized over this vote, but I came to grips with it today, and I came to grips with opposing this resolution during the very painful yet very beautiful memorial service. As a member of the clergy so eloquently said, as we act, let us not become the evil that we deplore. I agree. But what is striking to me as a linguist is the use of negatives in the statement, not prevent, restraint, inherently negative, not spiral out of control, not become the evil that we deplore. A petition was circulated calling for justice without vengeance. Without has another implicit negative. It is not that these negative statements are wrong, three negatives. What is needed is a positive form of discourse. There is one. The central concept is that of responsibility, which is at the heart of progressive liberal morality. See Moral Politics. Progressive liberal morality begins with empathy, the ability to understand others and feel what they feel. That is presupposed in responsibility. Responsibility for oneself, for protection, for the care of those who need care, and for the community. Those were the values that we saw in action among the rescue workers in New York right after the September 11th attack. Responsibility requires competence and effectiveness. If you are to deal responsibly with terrorism, you must deal effectively with all its causes, religious, social, and enabling. The enabling causes must be dealt with effectively. Bombing innocent civilians and harming them by destroying their country's domestic infrastructure will be counterproductive, as well as immoral. Responsibility requires care in the place of blundering, overwhelming force. Massive bombing would be irresponsible. Failure to address the religious and social causes would be irresponsible. The responsible response begins with joint international action to address all three, the social and political conditions and the religious worldview and the means, with all due care. Foreign policy. At a time when terrorist threats come from groups of individuals rather than states, when wars occur within nations, when free markets exist without freedom, when overpopulation threatens stability and disastrous global warming, when intolerant cultures limit freedom and promote violence, when transnational corporations act like oppressive governments, and when the oil economy threatens the planet's future, the central problems in today's world cannot be solved by state-level approaches. The state-level part of the answer is to recognize global interdependence and focus foreign policy on diplomacy, alliances, international institutions, and strong defensive and peacekeeping forces, with war as a last resort. But what is needed even more is a moral foreign policy, one that realizes that America can only be a better America if the world is a better world. America must become a moral leader using fundamental human values, caring and responsibility carried out with strength to respond to the world's problems. In a values-based foreign policy, issues that were not previously seen as part of foreign policy become central. Women's education is the best way to alleviate overpopulation and promote development. Renewable energy could make the world oil independent. Food, water, health, ecology, and corporate reform are foreign policy issues, as are rights. Rights of women, children, workers, prisoners, refugees, and political minorities. These issues were previously left to international advocacy groups, and many have done excellent work. But these issues need an integrated approach that requires a foreign policy that is serious about addressing them. The Obama administration is making moves in this direction with the understanding that these are foreign policy issues. The president is being attacked for it, and the media has not yet recognized them as foreign policy issues. Why? The metaphors that foreign policy experts have traditionally used to define what foreign policy is have ruled out these important concerns. The metaphors involve self-interest, for example, the rational actor model, stability, a physics metaphor, industrialization, unindustrialized nations are underdeveloped, growth, our current economics depend on growth, of markets and access to cheap labor and abundant cheap resources, and trade. Freedom is free trade. There is an alternative way of thinking about foreign policy under which all these humanistic issues would become a natural part of what foreign policy is about. The premise is that when international relations work smoothly, it is because certain moral norms of the international community are being followed. This mostly goes unnoticed since those norms are commonly followed. We notice problems when those norms are breached. Given this, it makes sense that foreign policy should be centered around those norms. The moral norms I suggest come out of what in moral politics I called nurturant morality. It is a view of ethical behavior that centers on empathy and responsibility for yourself and others needing your help. Many things follow from these central principles. Fairness, minimal violence, for example, justice without vengeance, an ethic of care, protection of those needing it, a recognition of interdependence, cooperation for the common good, the building of community, mutual respect, and so on. When applied to foreign policy, nurturant moral norms would lead the American government to uphold the Anti-Ballistic Missile, ABM Treaty, sign and uphold international environmental accords, engage in a form of globalization governed by an ethics of care, and it would automatically make all the concerns listed above, such as the environment and women's rights, part of our foreign policy. This, of course, implies 1. Multilateralism, 2. Interdependence, and 3. International cooperation. But these three principles without nurturant norms could equally well apply to a radically conservative foreign policy. Bush's foreign policy was one of self-interest. What's in the best interest of the United States, if not outright hegemony? The Cheney-Rumsfeld position. The Democratic leaders incorrectly criticized Bush for being isolationist and unilateralist on issues like the Kyoto Accords and the ABM Treaty. He was neither isolationist nor unilateralist. He was just following his stated policy of self-interest, using strict father morality as his guide. Imagine if Bush had happened to receive the full support of France, Germany, and the United Nations when he announced his policy. Then he would have been called an internationalist and multilateralist. When it was in America's interest, as he saw it, he would work with those nations willing to go along, the coalition of the willing. Whether Bush looked like a multilateralist depended on who was willing. Self-interest crosses the boundaries between unilateralism and multilateralism. The Bush foreign policy was one of unyielding self-interest. There is, interestingly, an apparent overlap between the nurturant norms policy and an idealistic vision of the war started by the Bush administration. The overlap is, simply, that it is a moral norm to refuse to engage in or support terrorism. From this perspective, it looked, at the onset, like left and right were united. It was an illusion. In nurturant norms policy, anti-terrorism arises from another moral norm. Violence against innocent parties is immoral. Within a year of the end of the Gulf War, the CIA reported that about 1 million Iraqi civilians had died from the effects of the war and the embargo, many from disease and malnutrition due to the U.S. destruction of water treatment plants, hospitals, electric generation plants, and so on, together with the inability to get food and medical supplies. Many more innocents have since died from the effects of the war. In conservative morality, there is a fight between good and evil, in which lesser evils are tolerated and even seen as necessary and expected. The argument that killing innocent civilians in retaliation would make us as bad as them may work for progressives, but not for conservatives. Be the change you wish to see in the world. If the United States wants terror to end, the United States must end its own contribution to terror. The foreign policy of moral norms, of diplomacy and economic leverage, minimizing the use of force, is the only sane and humane foreign policy. Domestic policy. After September 11th, I had a rational fear. A fear that the attack had given the Bush administration a free hand in pursuing a conservative domestic agenda. It could not be said by the media at the time, but it was true. No taxes from the wealthy were raised to pay for the war. Indeed, they were cut. The Social Security surplus was taken from the lockbox to pay for the war, with every Democrat in Congress except one voting for it. It was supposed to cost $40 billion. It actually cost $3 trillion so far, and counting, if you count the continuing costs of treating veterans injured in the war and of propping up governments in Iraq and Afghanistan. It ruined the economy of our country, our educational system, our infrastructure, and it has taken away a vast range of needed public resources. The poor and middle class got poorer, but the rich got richer, and the earth got warmer, and the conservative movement grew. It was another lesson in systemic causation. Foreign policy and domestic policy are inextricably linked. Guns made for war will be sold at gun shows and used to kill children. Drones and computer technology developed for the surveillance of enemies abroad will be used for surveillance of civilians at home, and money spent on war abroad will be drained from public resources at home. Chapter 12. Metaphors That Kill. March 18, 2003. Edited July 2014. The 2003 version of this chapter appeared just before the start of the Iraq War. It is reprinted here to provide a sense of what the study of framing brought to an understanding of that war before it happened. Metaphors Can Kill. That's how I began a piece on the Gulf War back in 1990, just before the war began. You can do a search of Metaphor and War at WordPress.com for a PDF of the article. Many of those metaphorical ideas are back, but within a very different and more dangerous context. Since the Iraq War is due to start any day, perhaps even tomorrow, it might be useful to take a look before the action begins at the metaphorical ideas being used to justify the Iraq War. One of the central metaphors in our foreign policy is that a nation is a person. It is used hundreds of times a day, every time the nation of Iraq is conceptualized in terms of a single person, Saddam Hussein. The war, we are told, is not being waged against the Iraqi people, but only against this one person. Ordinary American citizens are using this metaphor when they say things like, "Saddam is a tyrant. He must be stopped." What the metaphor hides, of course, is that the 3,000 bombs to be dropped in the first 2 days will not be dropped on that one person. They will kill many thousands of people hidden by the metaphor, people that we are, according to the metaphor, not going to war against. The nation as a person metaphor is pervasive, powerful, and part of an elaborate metaphor system. It is part of an international community metaphor in which there are friendly nations, hostile nations, rogue states, and so on. This metaphor comes with a notion of the national interest. Just as it is in the interest of a person to be healthy and strong, so it is in the interest of a nation person to be economically healthy and militarily strong. That is what is meant by the national interest. In the international community, peopled by nation persons, there are nation adults and nation children, with maturity metaphorically understood as industrialization. The children are the developing nations of the Third World in the process of industrializing, who need to be taught how to develop properly and must be disciplined, say by the International Monetary Fund, when they fail to follow instructions. Backward nations are those that are underdeveloped. Iraq, despite being the cradle of civilization, is seen via this metaphor as a kind of defiant armed teenage hoodlum who refuses to abide by the rules and must be taught a lesson. The international relations community adds to the nation as person metaphor what is called the rational actor model. The idea here is that it is irrational to act against your interests, and that nations act as if they were rational actors. Individual people trying to maximize their gains and assets and minimize their costs and losses. In the Gulf War, the metaphor was applied so that a country's assets included its soldiers, materiel, and money. Since the United States lost few of those assets in the Gulf War, the war was reported just afterward in the New York Times business section as having been a bargain. Because Iraqi civilians were not our assets, they could not be counted among the losses, and so there was no careful public accounting of civilian lives lost, people maimed, and children starved or made seriously ill by the war or the sanctions that followed it. Estimates vary from 500,000 to 1,000,000 or more. However, public relations was seen to be a U.S. asset. Excessive slaughter reported in the press would be bad PR, a possible loss. These metaphors are with us again. A short war with few U.S. casualties would minimize costs. But the longer it goes on, the more Iraqi resistance and the more U.S. casualties, the less the United States would appear invulnerable, and the more the war would appear as a war against the Iraqi people. That would be a high cost. According to the rational actor model, countries act naturally in their own best interests, preserving their assets, that is, their own populations, their infrastructures, their wealth, their weaponry, and so on. That is what the United States did in the Gulf War and what it is doing now. But Saddam Hussein in the Gulf War did not fit our government's rational actor model. He had goals like preserving his power in Iraq and being an Arab hero just for standing up to the great Satan. Though such goals might have their own rationality, they are irrational from the model's perspective. One of the most frequent uses of the nation as person metaphor comes in the almost daily attempts to justify the war metaphorically as a just war. The basic idea of a just war uses the nation as a person metaphor, plus two narratives that have the structure of classical fairy tales, the self-defense story and the rescue story. In each story, there is a hero, a crime, a victim, and a villain. In the self-defense story, the hero and the victim are the same. In both stories, the villain is inherently evil and irrational. The hero can't reason with the villain. He has to fight him and defeat or kill him. In both, the victim must be innocent and beyond reproach. In both, there is an initial crime by the villain, and the hero balances the moral books by defeating him. If all the parties are nation persons, then self-defense and rescue stories become forms of a just war for the hero nation. In the Gulf War, George H.W. Bush tried out a self-defense story. Saddam was threatening our oil lifeline. The American people didn't buy it. Then he found a winning story, a rescue story, The Rape of Kuwait. It sold well and is still the most popular account of that war. In the Iraq War, George W. Bush is pushing different versions of the same two story types, and this explains a great deal of what is going on in the American press and in speeches by Bush and Powell. If they can show that Saddam Hussein equals al-Qaeda, that he is helping or harboring al-Qaeda, then they can make a case for the self-defense scenario, and hence for a just war. Or if weapons of mass destruction ready to be deployed are found, the self-defense scenario can be justified in another way. Indeed, despite the lack of any positive evidence and the fact that the secular Saddam and the fundamentalist bin Laden despise each other, the Bush administration has managed to convince 40% of the American public of the link just by asserting it. The administration has told its soldiers the same thing, and so our military personnel see themselves as going to Iraq in defense of their country. In the rescue scenario, the victims are 1. The Iraqi people, and 2. Saddam's neighbors, whom he has not attacked but is seen as threatening. That is why Bush and Powell keep on listing Saddam's crimes against the Iraqi people and the weapons he could use to harm his neighbors. Again, most of the American people have accepted the idea that the Iraq War is a rescue of the Iraqi people and a safeguarding of neighboring countries. Actually, the war threatens the safety and well-being of the Iraqi people. And why such enmity toward France and Germany? Via the nation as person metaphor, they are supposed to be our friends. And friends are supposed to be supportive and jump in and help us when we need help. Friends are supposed to be loyal. That makes France and Germany fair-weather friends, not there when you need them. This is how the war is being framed for the American people by the administration and the media. Millions of people around the world can see that the metaphors and fairy tales don't fit the current situation, that the Iraq War does not qualify as a just war, a legal war. But if you accept all these metaphors, as Americans have been led to do by the administration, the press, and the lack of an effective democratic opposition, then the Iraq War would indeed seem like a just war. But surely most Americans have been exposed to the facts, the lack of a credible link between Saddam and al-Qaeda, no WMDs, weapons of mass destruction, found, and the idea that large numbers of innocent Iraqi civilians will be killed or maimed by our bombs. Why don't they reach the rational conclusion? One of the fundamental findings of cognitive science is that people think in terms of frames and metaphors, conceptual structures like those we have been describing. The frames are in the synapses of our brains, physically present in the form of neural circuitry. When the facts don't fit the frames are kept and the facts ignored. It is a common folk theory of progressives that the facts will set you free. If only you can get all the facts out there in the public eye, then every rational person will reach the right conclusion. It is a vain hope. Human brains just don't work that way. Framing matters. Frames, once entrenched, are hard to dispel. In the Gulf War, Colin Powell began the testimony before Congress. He explained the rational actor model to Congress and gave a brief exposition of the views on war of Clausewitz, the Prussian general. War is business and politics carried out by other means. Nations naturally seek their self-interest, and when necessary they use military force in the service of their self-interest. This is both natural and legitimate. To the Bush administration, this war furthers our self-interest in controlling the flow of oil from the world's second-largest known reserve, and in being in the position to control the flow of oil from Central Asia. This would guarantee energy dominance over a significant part of the world. The United States could control oil sales around the world. And in the absence of alternative fuel development, whoever controls the worldwide distribution of oil controls politics and economics. My 1990 paper did not stop the Gulf War. This paper will not stop the Iraq War. So why bother? I think it is crucially important to understand the cognitive dimensions of politics, especially when most of our conceptual framing is unconscious and we may not be aware of our own metaphorical thought. I have been referred to as a cognitive activist, and I think the label fits me well. As a professor, I do analyses of linguistic and conceptual issues in politics, and I do them as accurately as I can. But that analytic act is a political act. Awareness matters. Being able to articulate what is going on can change what is going on, at least in the long run. Part 5. From Theory to Action. Chapter 13. What Conservatives Want.